Greek life is under the microscope, and South Florida leaders come together to discuss climate change. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Last Friday, FIU's president suspended all Greek activities for a month in January. This comes in light of three deaths nationwide of fraternity pledges and members. We'll find out what this could mean for fraternities and sororities at FIU. We can't really know just how much sea level rise will impact South Florida in the coming century, but South Florida leaders are not waiting. They're trying to solve the upcoming problems now. We'll learn more about the recent summit focused on what political and business leaders are doing as they move forward on the issue. And then we sit down with artist Xavier Cortada about environmental art. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, Greek life on college campuses is getting a lot of attention lately, and it's not good stuff. There have been three deaths of fraternity pledges nationwide this year. One of those deaths was at Florida State University this fall. On Friday, FIU President Mark Rosenberg announced that all Greek life will be suspended for 1 month starting January of 2018. He cited, quote, growing concerns about Greek life at FIU and on other college campuses as the reason. We're joined now by Lance Dixon of the Miami Herald, who covered this story. All right, so Lance, really, why is the president deciding to end Greek life, again, just for a month starting in January? What were the reasons here, besides just these concerns that he's seeing?
The idea seems to be a desire to go back to the drawing board, in a sense, because he and other members of the administration there have noticed that these are just a few outliers, a couple of different fraternities who have had this behavior kind of spill over and become very public and who have been implicated in one way or another in some bad behavior. But as far as the 37 organizations that kind of exist on the campus, they feel like in general there's some steps that can be taken, but it's not just about punishing or looking at those individual bad institutions or organizations or the ones that have had these issues, but really looking at the entire spectrum and saying, okay, how can we kind of get a sort of checklist and best practices put together so that everybody is kind of operating off the same sort of set of guidelines?
So I'm hearing all that and I'm thinking, okay, best practices, try to start over again. Is Greek life getting out of hand? I mean, that's what I'm wondering.
Sure. I mean, it depends on who you talk to. Obviously, for the parents of these individuals who died after what seemed to be pretty significant hazing, you know, rituals or these different things where in several of these cases, these students were found with high blood alcohol content, you know, just the different things that have been dramatized in movies and TV shows for years are happening and continue to happen. And it's not really until something tragic happens or until sort of the worst of these kind of communications becomes public that people really get the sense of it. So I think that when you look at it, they're kind of just saying, hey, We know that for the most part, Greek life is something that people still admire. Alumni still contribute a great deal to it. People who are in these organizations do still do a lot of service. They carry out some of the tenets that these organizations were founded on. But at the same time, because of the party culture, because of the culture of initiation being something that is so much of a hallmark for these organizations, There's still some work to be done, I think.
Do we know if President Rosenberg has been speaking with other universities, specifically also FSU, because where one of these deaths occurred, they've suspended all Greek activities indefinitely?
Sure. So they've taken a stronger stance on this. And FIU said, you know, they don't plan to extend this beyond that month that will start in January. But if some other behavior spring up or if they find some other things, then it could go beyond that. But as far as meeting with other organizations, so the schools in Florida are actually coming together to meet next month. And it's something that the governor and other officials in the state have actually been looking at as well. The vice president of student affairs at the school, Larry Lunsford, told me that it has been a sort of group effort to kind of look at what can be done. And as far as national conversations, I mean, I think that different the different presidents and different schools where these things have happened. I think that there are, maybe they're not formal conversations, but informally, I think that people are kind of trying to take a look at what the future of Greek life should be.
I wonder what also with Greek life, have you heard from any of the, you know, fraternities, sororities, or anybody in a fraternity or sorority or a former member of any of these groups, what they said about this move and how do they feel about, you know, the school kind of putting a lot of spotlight on them right now?
Well, when the story and the announcement came out on Friday, it was actually a couple different commencement exercises happening at FIU, so wasn't that easy to sort of grab people. But I think in general, because even prior to this decision and prior to some of the negative things coming out from some of these chapters at FIU, there have been conversations with Rosenberg, with President Rosenberg and his administration, with the with those different Greek organizations on campus, and I think a lot of them are kind of trying to steer in the right direction. But yeah, I mean, it kind of remains to be seen. As far as the sorority reaction, though, when this incident happened with one of the chapters at FIU,
you're talking about the one with Tau Kappa Epsilon,
yes,
right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, Teak. So when they had their group chat sort of become public and were sharing all of these just, you know, really offensive, terrible messages that I guess they never thought would become public. A lot of the sororities on campus and even some members of the student government, they said, you know, this is not acceptable. The administration needs to step in and do something about this because we can't allow this kind of speech to be happening behind closed doors and still have these organizations be presented in this way and be allowed to kind of operate this way.
And we did talk about that that particular issue back in November. Again, the fraternity Tau Kappa Epsilon, it was leaked that there were screenshots of group chats and some of the members were talking about anti-Semitic jokes and comments, rape jokes that were nude photos of female students that were posted up without consent. What do we know about the investigation on that, though?
As far as I know, that's still ongoing. And there are, you know, there's some others that the school is looking at, but they haven't risen to the level of news reports and things like that, as far as I can tell. But when I spoke with Larry Lunsford, he said that they are just kind of taking a broad look at everything and, you know, just kind of trying to get a sense of what additional discipline might happen. But for now, Tau Kappa Epsilon remains suspended and we'll see where things go from there, I think.
Is President Rosenberg going to sit down and meet with all of these groups, with all Greek life organizations, to discuss what he's thinking? And you know, I'm wondering what I want to know from them, if they feel there has to be a culture shift, you know, within Greek life.
I think that is the case. And in speaking with Larry Lunsford with Student Affairs, he said that these meetings had happened before and these conversations had happened before. And then bad behavior still kind of, you know, found its way to the surface after those meetings. And it's for them, they say that's the sort of the most disappointing thing, because you have these sort of opportunities to share and exchange ideas and to kind of try to get a set of best practices or at least a sort of change in culture solidified. And then, you know, these things still kind of pop up. But I think that, yeah, the idea is to sort of change the climate, and they want to get national leaders involved. They want to get alumni groups involved. They want to have, I think, as broad of a conversation and as many people at the table as they can, because I think that ultimately the goal for them is not to just completely eradicate Greek life, because I think that because of how entrenched it is in so many college campuses, I think they understand that that would be something that would either be a very dramatic change or a change that would take a lot of effort and a lot of, you know, major overhaul for a college environment.
The big issue here is we're talking about with these deaths, especially, as sure. You mentioned, is the alcohol. And, you know, the issue of drugs, too, but, you know, the issue of alcohol, the sorts of parties that they throw. And, you know, everybody can have their stories depending on what school you go to, but we all have this idea of what frat life is like. And let's also say it for what it is, because it's fraternities where we see these problems. Do you get the sense, though, that fraternities and sororities are open to making big changes, especially when it comes to the issue of alcohol?
I mean, I think that at least in the reaction to what happened with Teak, it seems like the sororities took a look at some of the things that were being expressed in those messages, and it was kind of a wake-up call in a sense. And I think that fraternities will look at some of those things, and there might be some more changes there as well. Because I mean, obviously, we're in a kind of cultural moment right now in 2017, where so many institutions that have long been, you know, wary of scrutiny or that haven't really faced that kind of scrutiny are kind of having this magnifying glass put on them. And I think that Greek life is kind of having its moment in a sense, both because of those bad behaviors and especially because of the deaths. And so I think that there could be a sort of shift there, but ultimately, I mean, it's down to everybody getting to the table, I think, is sort of what the school is saying.
By the way, suspending all Greek life means what? They can't hold any activity of any kind?
No. So there are sort of some exceptions. The chapters will still be able to have their sort of regular chapter and council meetings and other sort of workshops. But the idea behind those is, okay, so we'll allow you to continue to have your meetings through January and through sort of the tail end of this month here in December. But we really want those meetings to be focused on, okay, how do we come forward to President Rosenberg, to members of the administration, to our fellow Greek leaders and say, hey, what are we going to do? What's our next step? What's our game plan? And so I think that that's kind of why they've allowed those meetings to still take place so that people can still organize. But as far as parties and different social things like that, that's not going to be happening.
Is President Rosenberg getting pressure from somebody outside of the school?
That I'm not sure of. But I mean, I think that when you look at the attention that the particular actions of Teat got, and just looking at what's happened, whether it's at Florida State or Penn State or these other schools. And even, you know, if you look historically, what happened at Florida A&M with that incident with the band, that individual who passed because of a hazing incident.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that these things have kind of been simmering underneath the surface for a little bit. And now that there's been this sort of back-to-back-to-back occurrence of these really serious serious situations, and just looking at the reaction from, I think, students too is probably a bigger thing here, is in looking at how student government members, how members of these sororities that even interact with some of these fraternities at FIU, they're saying, you know, this really can't stand. There needs to be some stronger action here.
Lance Dixon, a reporter with the Miami Herald, covering the story again that Florida International University President Mark Rosenberg on Friday announced that all Greek activities, all Greek life, suspended for 1 month starting January of 2018. Lance, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Liz.
And if you are a member of any Greek fraternity, or maybe you were fraternity or sorority, or maybe you were in the past, what are your thoughts on this? We'd love to hear from you, especially if you went to FIU or are currently going there. Find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. All right, coming up, South Florida leaders recently gathered for a climate summit. What did we learn from it? That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. So an earlier report from the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration projected that, worst case estimates, seas could rise by 6 feet within the next 80 years. We may not stop the seas, but we still have to prepare. In comes the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact. It's a gathering of community leaders from Palm Beach County to Monroe County, where they discuss the issues of climate change and sea level rise and how these cities along the coast are going to adapt. One of the speakers at this year's event, which was held last week, by the way, in Fort Lauderdale, was U.S. Congressman Ted Deutsch. He said this about the role this compact will play moving forward.
While many Americans might be able to ignore climate change science based on their own personal experiences, we cannot. We can't put climate change out of sight. We can't put it out of mind. And therefore, we must, and by we, I mean clear-headed Democrats, Republicans, and independents, we must effectively communicate our observations and experiences in Florida to those with less direct exposure.
Well, WLRN's Kate Stein was at the summit that was held again last week at Fort Lauderdale. Let's find out what they discussed, what we learned, and what community leaders are going to be doing moving forward. Kate, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that sounded like a lot of fun, by the way. I know that you enjoy
it. It was a blast.
I mean, a lot of workshops, a lot of conversations, and so let's talk about some of them. But is there one or two things that you heard a lot during the summit? Was there something that dominated the conversation?
Well, there are a couple of things that really stood out to me. So first of all, it's pretty well established, but definitely worth repeating, that climate change and associated impacts like sea level rise, they're going to have the biggest effect on vulnerable people, low-income people, people who are elderly and less able to prepare for these things. Because, for example, as the planet warms, you know, if you can't afford to pay for air conditioning because you're low income, then that could be a health risk. You know, it gets hot. Or if you're a field worker in Homestead or Pahokee, you know, outside working 12 hours a day in the sun and temperatures are rising, that can be bad for your health. And also, you know, in South Florida, specifically with sea level rise, rising seas, more flooding, and your car can rust. And if you're spending most of your income on rent, because we have such housing can be unaffordable here, how do you pay for that?
That's what I find is interesting is, like, a lot of times when we talk about the sea level rise, we talk about the flooding, we talk about the coastal flooding, we talk about, you know, the cities along the coast having to deal with this, you know, this inundation of water, but really it's all these other little issues we don't think about.
Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of another thing that we heard a lot about, how there we have so many little issues that are going to be impacted by climate change. There's a lot of opportunity within that to innovate as far as addressing some of our chronic problems like transportation and unaffordable housing. As we deal with those things, we can deal with them in a way that makes them less acute and also makes them resilient to problems like rising seas.
What is the compact? When did this start?
So this started, this was the 9th annual summit, and this compact is basically an agreement between Miami-Dade, Monroe, Palm Beach, and Broward counties, where leaders from the government, from local nonprofits, all kind of got together and put their heads together and have come up with just this massive list of all the different challenges that South Florida is facing, with regard to rising seas in particular, but also some of the other things that I talked about with, like, transportation and housing. And basically it's a sharing of ideas on how to address these different challenges.
All right. So there are all these different workshops and speeches. Which ones did you get to go see?
Well, I was there for pretty much all of 2 days. This
was last Thursday and Friday.
Thursday and Friday. And one of the things that I thought really stuck out was how the business community, I mean, the theme of this particular summit on the compact was how the business community can be more involved in addressing some of these regional challenges. And so we heard a lot from business leaders about, you know, what are some of the maybe the ways that the private sector can play a role in hopefully going forward, helping communities figure out ways to address these challenges.
So you have these different groups, chambers of commerce groups, and how do they feel about the issue? We don't hear from them enough on this.
Yeah, well, I think they're really starting to look at it as an opportunity to, you know, bring some of the best and brightest minds to South Florida, because we, you know, we hear it all the time, but we're ground zero for sea level rise. So maybe Miami and Fort Lauderdale and Palm Beach and the Keys could be a place where we innovate. Like, how, what are we doing with our roads that's making them resilient to sea level rise? And then can we take that and market it to other places that are having challenges that are similar to ours? And things like that.
You talk about roads. That's one of the topics that was discussed, the issue of infrastructure, the possibility of having to raise roads. We already see this in Miami Beach, raising roads, raising sidewalks, possibly raising structures. I mean, was that a big conversation, and how do people feel about that idea?
Yeah, it was definitely a big conversation. And a lot of the people in the room were sort of the ones at the county level who are in the back room working away on, like, what's the exact amount that we need to raise the road by, or how many pumps do we need to install to deal with sea level rise. So a lot of this, like, technical stuff was a little over my head. But what was really interesting is that I think people are beginning to coalesce behind the fact that action needs to happen sooner rather than later. And county and cities in South Florida really need to take the lead on this, because they don't necessarily anticipate a lot of support from the state or federal government, at least financially.
Again, talking with WLRN's Kate Stein, she was in attendance last week at the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact. They had a summit in Fort Lauderdale. Again, leaders from Palm Beach County down to Monroe County, all in attendance, talking about the issue of climate change and how it impacts this area. and what leaders here in South Florida are doing to deal with this issue. Now, you talk about Governor Rick Scott. Well, you mentioned state leaders.
The state,
but he is the governor. So mentioning him and the fact that, you know, some of the leaders in Tallahassee don't talk about the issue much. Obviously, the governor's been, you know, accused of trying to get rid of the word climate change, not wanting to have it mentioned with a number of state agencies. And now you're saying that some of the leaders down here in South Florida don't think they're going to get any support from Tallahassee, or very little.
I wouldn't necessarily go that far, but I think they are acutely aware that this Rick Scott administration hasn't exactly been helpful in terms of having discussions on climate change and sea level rise in the past. And they are concerned for the future, that if that trend continues with whoever's elected governor of Florida next, you know, how is South Florida going to be able to cope with that?
Do they think they just have to go it alone?
Not necessarily. It kind of goes back to what I was saying about there being opportunities within everything that's happening as far as sea level rise and climate change in South Florida. There's kind of this burgeoning sense that private innovators and the business community and investors are going to be the ones to drive whatever technological advances we see, or whatever advances in financing we see. So for example, maybe something like there's this new thing called a resilience bond that's in the works, which is basically a way for cities and counties to, if they make investments in improving their infrastructure, that can have payoffs for investors. And that could be a potential way to get the business community involved in supporting some of these resilience initiatives. In addition to, you know, if you're developing a new technology in South Florida, again, is that something we can maybe export as expertise that our region has and can offer to other places around the world that are facing similar challenges with sea level rise?
In town today, the president and the North American regional director for the 100 Resilient Cities program. What's the program?
So 100 Resilient Cities is an international program that's funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. And it basically pays for approximately 100 cities around the world to have a chief resilience officer, who is the person who oversees sort of this whole concept of resilience and how it's implemented in the city. And then this program also connects cities with resilience officers across the world. So, for example, Miami-Dade, Miami Beach, and the city of Miami are the South Florida collective that's in this program that's been selected. And their resilience officers were recently in Chile, I believe, somewhere in South America, learning from their counterparts about what whichever city in South America it was is doing to address some of the resilience challenges that we face here.
Are there any other cities around the world that are similar to South Florida cities and that sea level rise is impacting them right now, and maybe they're doing something we can take an idea?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, New Orleans is one. Obviously, they face a similar situation with rising seas and a vulnerable environment because it's also a very coastal area, obviously. Norfolk, Virginia, I think, is also in 100 Resilient Cities. They have a very sort of sea-based economy with, I think there's a naval base there and a lot of shipping that goes on. The Netherlands, as far as sea level rise, there are several cities in the Netherlands that are in the 100 Resilient Cities program. And also the Dutch consulate here is really active as far as educating local leaders on, you know, what works in the Netherlands for building resilient infrastructure and building infrastructure that's kind of multi-purpose. So it's resilient to rising seas, but it also addresses things like, in their case, a lack of, I think there was one program I heard about where it was like they built a park because there was a lack of green space, and they built that park into a seawall, or they build shops into a seawall. So you're bringing jobs and you're boosting the economy, but also coping with rising seas.
All right. By the way, at this 100 Resilient Cities program, there was a press conference this morning, and leaders from that program appeared with the mayors of Miami, Miami-Dade, and Miami Beach. What did they say?
So the program this morning was because Miami and Miami Beach just elected new mayors, Francis Suarez and Dan Gelber. And basically what happened before this press conference is the president and the North America director for 100 Resilient Cities and the chief resilience officers from Miami-Dade and Miami and Miami Beach and the Mayor Jimenez from Miami-Dade County and then the two new mayors all sat down in a room and basically went over like what this program is, what it's addressing, and sort of recommitted to the goals of 100 resilient cities and to their partnership. And it was interesting because Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez, well, I think the mayors in general, it was interesting to hear them because I think they sort of struggled to articulate this concept of resilience and that it's more than just addressing climate change and sea level rise. It's addressing all the livability challenges that are just going to be exacerbated by those two topics. And I think that's something that the administration, in particular of Mayor Jimenez, could improve upon because in his case, he's been, you know, this program, Miami and the greater Miami area has been in this program for more than a year, I think going on 2 years now. And he, you know, was really struggling to articulate what the challenges were. And so I think it's something that on the county level, but also within the cities, there needs to be more communication internally on what exactly this program does and how it's trying to break different departments out of their silos and bring them together.
This is not so much a partisan issue. It's not a partisan issue, but we see down here in South Florida, Republicans and Democrats side by side working on this issue. What do they think of that? And the fact that maybe their counterparts in Tallahassee or in Washington, D.C. are not always on the same side on this issue.
Well, I think you heard it in Representative Deutsch's quote at the top of this segment where he's kind of making the point that I think a lot of people feel here, which is that, you know, we're not necessarily expecting support from the state or the federal government. So it's really up to leaders in Southeast Florida to figure out what the solutions are going to be and then lobby for ourselves, for the community here, the communities here, to address these challenges. So, I mean, there are a handful of Republicans at the state level who are more on the same page as I think the Democrats are by and large as far as addressing sea level rise. On the national level, Congressman Deutsch has put together this Climate Solutions Caucus, which brings together lawmakers who are interested in addressing climate change problems. And to join, if you're a Democrat who wants to join, you have to bring on a Republican with you. So he's really making an effort to make it a bipartisan coalition.
As we finish up this summit again, you know, what's the takeaway from this particular summit? Again, this is the ninth annual, but what was the main message for this one? If there was one.
Yeah, I think that it's a message of optimism. I mean, it's an acknowledgement there are some really, really severe challenges that Southeast Florida is already facing. And, you know, there's not a widespread understanding necessarily among even some county leaders, the extent to which those challenges are interrelated. But I think despite that, the people at the summit were pretty optimistic that by working together on the local level, they're going to be able to come up with solutions to address these various problems in a way that's efficient because it tackles more than one problem at once. And also hopefully effective and can be a model for other communities around the world.
Again, that summit was the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact Group putting together the summit. They meet annually. Leaders from Palm Beach County and Monroe, all the way down to Monroe County, coming together every year to talk about these issues of climate change and sea level rise. And as we heard from Kate, so many of the other problems that come up from these issues. WLRN's Kate Stein was there. If you want to learn more about it, you can always go and find some stories about it at WLRN.org. Kate, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
All right. Turning nature and science into art, talking about the environment. We're going to have a conversation with artist Xavier Cortada. That's coming up next here on Sundial, here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about the environment, but also art. Xavier Cortada blends art with science in his work, which can be found literally at the ends of the earth. He's done installations at both the North and South Poles. His work appears in many museums, including half a dozen here in South Florida alone. He's created artworks for the White House, the World Bank, the CERN Lab in Switzerland, and the Florida Governor's Mansion. He's an artist in residence at Florida International University, and he's also currently doing a residence at Pinecrest Gardens. And it's just a lot going on, so we're going to have a lot of fun today. Xavier, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for being here.
Honored to be here. Really, really happy to share with you and your listeners.
And they may be, well, they may go online and see something. But
awesome. Yeah.
Your work often is inspired by science. I find this fascinating. Has that always been the case?
I mean, as a kid, I was absolutely enthralled by science and by art. My dad's an artist, but I really loved science, and all throughout my entire upbringing. I went to school blocks away from here at Jesu Catholic. It's now a parking lot.
Okay.
It's not even a real parking lot. It's asphalt. It's nothing.
I don't even recall it.
It's an empty lot. As a kid, I remember doing a lot of experiments and stuff like that. And I really, really, really was engaged and loved science. I went to the University of Miami studying biology and chemistry before finding my way through a really circuitous way to art. But at the core, yeah, it was these two things that were experimental, these two things that were about innovative and discovery, right? Both science and, of course, art.
When's the first time that you brought these two worlds together?
Well, that's a good question. They came about as a problem solving effort. So maybe I do need to tell you what happened after the University of Miami.
All right.
While I was at the University of Miami, I was a founder of Regis House along with this Jesuit priest called Father Lorena, Drug Rehab Center, and I served in the city's youth gang task force. So a lot of the work was about engaging communities, doing community organizing in Little Havana, creating a group called Vecinos en Acción, just basically working through Regis House and then upon graduation from law school as a member of the U of M team at the Department of Psychiatry. Again, working in community, doing community organizing. At my core, I always did painting. I did that as an undergrad. I did it all along. But in that approach, I realized that there was this tool that I had, which is called art. So when I started engaging in communities, and especially when they sent me away to do some speeches in Latin America and in South Africa on behalf of the U.S. Embassy to talk about the work we were doing at the University of Miami about engaging communities and working with gangs and helping families address drug addiction issues, I found the power of art to be incredible as a way of engaging others and having this conversation where everything was disarmed. Everyone felt really comfortable connecting with one another.
But what was it exactly?
I went to South Africa in 1994. Apartheid had ended a few months earlier. I was in Soweto at the IPLEG Center. I had done public speaking forever, but here I was in a room full of kids who only spoke a Zulu dialect, and here I am talking to them. And we just start drawing with one another, and they're talking to me about their addictions by depicting them, and I'm doing the same thing. And this conversation that happened, not through words, but through visuals, was really instrumental. That's the point where I said, you know what, there's something really powerful here in this thing that I've had in the sort of my back pocket my whole life as a hobby, right? I remember as a biology student at the University of Miami frat house, the guys would, have fun with the works that I was creating. So all my life I've been painting. My law schools are full of doodles. That's all it is, doodles. Thank God a TED Talk told me that was okay, that you learn more when you doodle. But, oh my God, it's nothing but doodles. But it wasn't until that point in 94 where I realized that this was a real force. But it came about as a problem solving. It came about using art as a way of trying to, in this case, connect with these kids. And through the years, the art grew. So my first pieces, again, remember, I was at a medical school, so a lot of the focus was doing murals for the World AIDS Conference, addressing all the social issues that I had tackled, in my capacity as a lawyer, and now are being tackled in my capacity as an artist. And I remember in 2000, I was in Cyprus. The U.S. Embassy sent me there, and we're talking about the kids in the northern and southern part of this divided island. So on the green line, the U.N. sort of buffer zone to prevent these two warring sides, from their continued violence, we created a mural where I used the environment as a way of finding common ground. And we talked about how an oil spill in the north would affect the south, a fire in the south would affect the north. And we created this piece called Listen to the Children of the Green Island. And these were all hearing impaired kids from an island that was hardly green anymore. And then we planted trees as part of that process. So to me, that was really probably, without me even realizing it, that was how I transitioned from a purely social justice work with kids in adult prison and addressing really important social and justice concerns. Began transitioning slowly into environment, and before you knew it, I'm in the South Pole doing climate change work.
That is an amazing journey.
Yeah.
When you think back on that, when you think about how you go from point A to B, C, D, all the way to where you are, what goes through your mind?
A journey is the answer. It's life is process. It's I think I'm strategic in the way I create art and I approach my art making. I mean, there is a reason for it, but you don't know today how that will lead, because everything is an experiment and everything is about interaction. Everything is about engaging others, and you don't know exactly how those partnerships or those collaborations are going to take hold, and you're driven by those. Sort of like evolution, right?
No,
you adapt and move.
We evolve. You talk about it, and I'm glad that you brought up the North and South Pole. That was the longitudinal installation in Antarctica, was the one in the South Pole.
Yeah, and then I repeated it
the North Pole.
A year later at the North Pole. Sure.
Where did this idea come from? Which, by the way, because look at the photo, for example, of this program is fascinating. You set up basically what looks like it's just a pole, mm-hmm. and shoes all around the pole, and each of these shoes are lined up with the different longitudes mm-hmm. of the globe. What are you trying to say with this?
So this was 2006, and back then we weren't paying as much attention to sea level rise and climate change, and I was honored to receive a very competitive grant to go to the South Pole and create this art piece, among others, including some paintings where I melted the very ice that threatens to drown our city, where I created pieces about the sixth mass extinction, where I created murals with a scientist there yearning to figure out why it is that they've devoted their life to this pursuit of knowledge. But what I really, really wanted to do is create a piece about empathy and a piece about the understanding that what impacts Tuvalu or Rwanda or Japan or the Great Barrier Reef impacts us, and that we're really all interconnected. Back then, we thought that, at least some folks thought that climate change, wouldn't get to us or had nothing to do with us. In fact, the words climate change and sea level rise weren't really part of our vocabulary. But I knew that if I could create some proximity between those who were affected, then I could begin to have us react.
I'm curious about the fact that, because a lot of times we talk about sea level rise, we're talking about polar caps melting mm-hmm. as a big part of that. You got the chance to stand on one.
Right.
Well,
so
how does that change your view of the issue?
Yeah, well, standing on there clearly made an impact, but it's being informed by the scientists who were standing next to me on that ice sheet and telling me what was going on that really made the difference. I created art in Antarctica about Antarctica, but with the medium of Antarctica, literally ice from the core samples that the scientists gave me, but about Antarctica. And the proximity issue was this. Across the globe, we're miles and miles apart, but of course all the longitudes converge at the South Pole. So whereas we're an eight-hour flight, from Europe, at the South Pole, I was two steps away from the other shoes. So I got quotes from 24 people across the globe and literally placed the shoes that I put their longitudes on the floor, and then stood in their shoes and recited their quotes. So conceptually, what I was trying to do was bring the world closer and making a point at the point where all the longitudes converge, and literally at the point on a 3-kilometer deep ice sheet that threatens to melt and drown my city. So I was trying to make that point at that location.
And did you repeat the same thing at the North Pole?
So at the North Pole, I repeated the same thing. At the South Pole, I used men's shoes. At the North Pole, I used women's shoes. And then since then, over the last decade, have repeated this in a bunch of places, the Nobel Peace Center, the Peabody Essex Museum, the Exploratorium, the Bishop Museum, Auburn University, a bunch of universities, FIU, where I'm artist in residence. And just during Art Basel, we inaugurated a replica of that pole and a ceramic replica of the 24 shoes and placed it as a permanent sculpture at Pinecrest Gardens. And we had students from Palmer Trinity come, joined by the leadership of our state's cultural division, to dedicate that sculpture, along with, of course, all the Pinecrest Village leadership. And we did so because during the beginning of every season, in a city that doesn't really understand seasons, we are going to do a performance. We're going to repeat that performance where 24 people will each stand in their respective longitude and recite the quote of these 24 people, people who talked about how they're falling through the ice or how their drought is not causing crops to happen or how their fishing industry is falling apart. And the next one happens soon because the winter solstice, winter is coming. Winter is coming. So
eventually there will be some winter at some point here in South Florida. But
well, but technically the actual solstice happens on December 21st. So at 10:30 a.m., I would love for 24 of your listeners to join me at Pinecrest Garden. We're right behind the Banyan Bull. There's a beautiful sculpture there. Literally the pole has been replicated as ceramic. And in the most informal way possible, come have, I'm going to call it a spiritual experience, if nothing else. It's a way of bringing in the new season by thinking about the people all across our planet who have been impacted by climate change. And every equinox and every solstice at 10:30 a.m., we will be doing this four times a year.
Again, talking with artist Xavier Cortada, and he just mentioned he's looking for 24, you said.
Yep,
looking 24 for 24 people. Listeners to come out and join him for the winter solstice, this special project that he's doing. We'll learn more about that. We're going to take a quick break here. We'll learn a little bit more about that and some of his other projects here on Sundial and WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined in studio with artist Xavier Cortada, talking about how he mixes science, climate, and art. We heard his story. We heard about how he got to it. And you know what? If you want to know more, by the way, about his North Pole, South Pole project, we'll have that on our website as well. Fascinating images. What are you working on right now, Xavier?
Well, I am currently hosting an exhibit at Pinecrest Gardens where I have my studio and help run the Hibiscus Gallery. And it's a show called Epoch. And it has to do with the animals that lived here on planet Earth for the last 540 million years.
We get to talk about dinosaurs, basically.
Well, you know, there's also trilobites and, yes, you know, all sorts of other fun stuff. But the important thing I think I want to talk about is, and I hate to be a Debbie Downer here, but we're literally in the middle of the sixth mass extinction, and that's a really big deal.
It's okay. It's only a Monday, so
right? I mean, I don't know how. I mean, as a look, it would have been so cool to be an artist, maybe, you know, 100 years ago or 300 years ago when life wasn't so complicated. You know, as artists, our job is a really hard job. I know that everyone has this thing of this idyllic artist sitting with a paintbrush, you know, whatever. Look, our job is to change the world at the end of the day. And our job is to try to do that by having people reframe the way they see themselves in context to one another, the natural world, and through space and time. And it's hard for you to understand that nature isn't where it's supposed to be, because you go to Biscayne Bay, you go on your kayak, you see some seagrasses and you see some fish, so you think the bay is teeming, but you don't realize how much it has changed and how much loss there is. So as an artist, I have to figure out what tools I can use to break through the entire sort of visual overload that all of us have, and all the knowledge overload that we have, and all the biases that exist, and all you know, the you know, sort of subjective, polarized perspectives that people have. Break through all that crap to try to bring understanding as to, you know, where we are today. And where we are today, we are a killer species. We are the most powerful species that has evolved on this planet. We went from the middle of the food chain to the apex. And we are now in the middle of an epoch where we, through agriculture, pesticides, development, hunting, poaching, and most importantly, through the climate change that we create through the release of greenhouse gases, as you probably talked at great length in your earlier episode, have disturbed the natural state of our planet. So what I did is I created a piece where I showed how over 540 million years, the four nucleotides that we have in our body created all these life forms, and through time they evolved. But that's the whole point. Through time, through geological time, through 540 million years they evolved. But right now we're at a collapse point where half of our species are going to go extinct. And that's crazy.
Are you an optimist or are you a cynic?
If I was a pessimist, I really wouldn't be doing this. I'm doing this to effectuate change, right? I'm doing this to try to get us to change our behaviors, to become better citizens, to vote in better elected officials, to become better educated so that we are not manipulated into voting against our interests.
And do you think that through art, that's going to be the best way to reach people?
Art is a very broad, right? It's a very broad way of talking about what I do. And I do believe that out of all the titles and degrees I could ever have, artist is the most appropriate. But artist also can let you fall into a trap, right? It could make you think about something where your audience is a curator or a collector or a commodity, you know, market. So art could make you fall into the trap of having have to be an object or being aesthetic. So if you define art in a narrow way, then probably I'd be wasting my time. But if you think of art as the way I think of art, right, as a way of what I talked a little bit earlier, the job of a present day artist, which understands all of that and has to navigate through the art world, through general society, through political world, you know, through time, then I think art is actually the only way, because it's what's really created our race as we evolved, as we moved out of Africa and continually went from location to location, hunting and gathering, as the environment pushed us and pulled us across every continent in the globe. It was our art making, our way of thinking in abstract ways and communicating those abstract ideas that literally made us human and created cultures and civilizations. And I think the only thing that's going to save the day today is that. At the end of the day, anything other than eating or defecating has to be a thought process, something that we as a society, right, have to come to do. And I think artists can lead us in that thought activity.
I always like to ask artists, musicians, painters, writers of any kind, why living here is good for their work. But I almost get the sense with your work, this may be the perfect place.
I think my work is defined by the place. Had I been living in another place, it'd be different work. And what I crave more than anything else is for my fellow artists to understand the power of their role, beyond what they do with their hands, but more importantly, what they do with their brains. And to continue breaking out from the very narrow way of looking at what artists do as objects of art, and think of what artists do, which are effectuators of change, and to embrace that role. In fact, I'd love to create the Miami School, which is really about not a particular form of expression as much as it is about a particular form of engagement, because I told you I went to school a few blocks away from here, and you know, a bulldozer got rid of Corinthian columns of Jesu Catholic school. But the sea is going to get rid of everything that has been built since those columns were put down, and of every memory I've ever had. I've been here since I'm 2.5 years old. And there needs to be a way where we as artists can help Miami understand that we can navigate this chaos. First of all, we need to understand that sea level is really going to cause everything that we've ever loved to go underwater. So how do we transition as a city? And I believe of Miami not as a place, but as a process. As the son of two Cuban refugees who lost it all and had to rebuild it again, I know that in our DNA, we can rebuild and move and grow Miami in the century to come.
Real quickly, remind everybody of this project you're working on, because you're looking for some people to help you.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, come join me at 10:30 for the longitudinal installation. And it's just a way of celebrating the new season at Pinecrest Gardens, 10:30 a.m. Come recite the 24 quotes with me.
All right. Again, Xavier Cortada, artist. He's the artist in residence at Florida International University. He's also currently doing a residence at Pinecrest Garden. So we'll have some information on that coming up as well. Xavier, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks so
Loved
much.
Loved it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. Remember, you can find us on iTunes. Look up WLRN Sundial. Have a wonderful day. Talk to you tomorrow.